Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executive After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. Those of you checking this out for the very first time, I say a thank you. As you notice, I'm trying not to shout because I've got two kids, one room away, trying to sleep here. Still in Portugal, about a week and a half to go, and then I'm back in the Middle East. Today on the podcast, I had the pleasure, this guy was amazing, so nice, to interview Mr. Lee Cockrell. Not only is he a best-selling author, but he's the former executive vice president of operations at Walt Disney World and Resorts. How fun would that be, right? Like many of my stories, Lee had this crucible that not only defined who he is when he was young in his career, but also through reflection, he evolved. And what was great about this is we talked about the role of integrity and showing up and trust. And he just kind of makes me feel good about the book I'm writing. Just another example that I was onto something. So I'm really excited about that. And as always, like I said last week, if your organization is looking for any type of speaker, obviously for me around the concept of authentic leadership or even a half-day seminar, please reach out at james@drjameskelly.com. I also want to say thank you to my content partner, C-Suite Radio, as well as Engage Me, an online magazine for employees who are interested in the best of engagement. All right, everyone. Have an awesome week. See you. Well, today I got Lee Cockrell on the podcast, Executive After Hours. Lee, thank you so much for stopping by.
Yeah, great to be with you.
So can you just quickly give my audience the 10,000-foot level of who you are, what you're doing now, and why are you talking to me?
Well, currently I'm retired, but I spent many, many years in the hotel and entertainment business and started as a banquet waiter back in 1965 at the Washington Hilton, up there where John Hinckley shot President Reagan. And John Hinckley was from my hometown, Ardmore, Oklahoma. But I worked for Hilton for 8 years, got into management training and became food and beverage director of several hotels, moved from Washington to Chicago to the Waldorf Astoria in New York to Los Angeles. And then I joined Marriott in 1973 and arose to be the vice president of food and beverage for them over 17 years. And then I was recruited by Disney in 1990 to open Disneyland Paris, which I did. And then I was back in Orlando for another 13 years before I retired.
Wow.
So that's the quick career.
All right. Well, that's it. That's a wrap. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So many questions. First of all, I must point out that I just moved from Ardmore, Pennsylvania out here. And so often when I would Google search Ardmore, I'd get Ardmore, Oklahoma. So
well, Ardmore, Oklahoma was named after Ardmore, Pennsylvania, by the way.
Oh, really?
There was an oil tanker came through there back in the early 1900s, and actually it blew up, caught on fire, burned the town almost down. And they rebuilt it, and they named it Ardmore.
Yeah. Fantastic. So what was life like back in Ardmore when you're growing up, back in the, 40s, 50s?
Yeah, well, it was pretty sweet. You know, the biggest, worst thing we ever did is drink a beer. And maybe smoked a cigarette or two along the way, but we were pretty well behaved. It was a small community. Everybody knew you. I grew up on a little farm up in northern Oklahoma. I had to milk a cow every day, and farm life was fun for kids and not fun for adults. And we did that, and then my dad moved. We moved to Ardmore from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, up north, and I went to school there. I never stepped foot out of Oklahoma till I was 20 years old. Never been on vacation, never been anywhere, never stayed in a hotel. And when you live on a farm, you don't go on vacation because the cows, you know, they need to be milked. But it was great. It was that special time in America, you know. We had fun. I was there when Elvis Presley showed up, and the teen years were fun, and it was just, I think we had a party every weekend at somebody's house, and we didn't have a lot of money back then, but we were just as happy as could be. So it was quiet times, people pretty much behaved.
I would imagine during that time period too, like, the trust factor that your parents had for you and your behavior, they were like, yeah, there's mischief and that's about it, right? There wasn't, he's going to do something ridiculous.
No, actually, we never even talked about that kind of stuff. I never even thought about doing something really nuts and crazy. But our parents really didn't check up on us much. We went out and did what we wanted to do. We'd be gone for the whole day when we were young, and she didn't know where we were and didn't – I don't know if she cared or not.
And did you have siblings that you were mischievous with?
Yeah, I have a brother who's 2 years younger, and we did a lot of things that we don't want our mother to know about.
So as you're growing up on this farm, though, I imagine the biggest lesson you get is hard work.
You know, that's funny you say. Yeah, it is. It's work. But when you're young, it didn't seem like work. It was just that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. We didn't know any different. You just do these things. And I milked a cow every morning. We had to clean up. We had to work on the farm. We had to work on the summer when they were out baling the hay for the cows. And my brother and I laughed back. We didn't know. We just thought it was great. We were outside. We had a dog. And we had more fun than you could shake a stick at.
How old were you when you started doing, like, basically everyday chores?
I was probably third grade, about 8 or 9, yeah.
So I think about that because my oldest son, not to age you, I guess, but my oldest son is 9 now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started thinking about, all right, so doing this podcast, and I'll ask you this question so you can think about it now, but I think I know the answer, is one of the questions I ask is during this segment called Fast Five is, what was your first job ever? And what I always find just fascinating is the amount of really successful people that started doing some sort of job between 10 and 13.
Yeah.
Like early on. Yeah. You learn to work hard and you don't know it's hard work. You just know what it is at the end of the day.
Well, you know, that's what life on a farm is all about. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to do and it has to be done and it has to be done at the same time every day. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't milk the cows at 2 p.m. It's got to be in the morning and in the evening. And you learn to be on time. You learn discipline. You learn hard work. It's hot, you know. And even though we look at later on, my son didn't have to work by the time he was old enough. I was doing very well, but we still sent him out to Oklahoma to work on a ranch every summer.
I remember growing up.
And then he sent his kids to work in horticulture at Disney and pull weeds for the summer.
That's awesome.
And 100 degrees and working, and they made their money. And I think it's critical that young people have increasing responsibility. And
I'm a huge fan of that. And that's something that, you know, not only did I believe in it, by 13, I was mowing yards. So, you know, I had to, if I wanted to buy something, we didn't have any money. So they're like, if you want X, you have to go earn money for it.
Absolutely.
And so that's something for sure that my kids will all do between 10 and 15, 10 and 13. I think even earlier is better in some ways. But I was thinking, as you leave Oklahoma, where did you go first?
Well, when I left Oklahoma the summer before I left, I finally went out to Lake Tahoe, Nevada, and worked at Harvey's Casino. And I worked in the food and beverage in the kitchen. My job was emptying the grease from the griddles. And I worked in housekeeping, vacuuming, and cleaning bathrooms. And then when I came back, I went in the Army. I didn't go back to school. I went to the Army, and I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana. And that's how my away from school life started. I learned a lot in the Army, I must say. It was, you talk about discipline.
Do you remember, can you recall, like, when you arrive in Reno, you know, here's a farm boy from Oklahoma going to Reno. Like, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
Yeah, actually it was Tahoe, just about 20 miles up the road.
That's what I meant.
I'd never been in. I was in shock almost. I mean, like, good grief, what's going on here? I mean, those casino life and everything was glittering. And I mean, I had more fun that summer working up there than you can imagine. It was just actually, I even got arrested for gambling underage with a fake ID. So I got put in jail for 4 hours.
Yeah.
And then I got bailed out. The judge, I saw him the next morning, and the bail was 100, and he gave me 75 back and told me I better not see you in the casino again this summer.
And then how that's awesome. How long were you in the military?
I was I joined the reserves in 1964, and I did basic training. Then I was in the reserves for 8 years, and
were you ever deployed? Because that was Vietnam era.
You know, it's funny. Our unit wasn't deployed, but a lot of my friends were in different units that were deployed. And so it's just a hit or miss. But we did get deployed one time. I lived in New York City, and I came home. My wife said, "You were called up to duty today." And it was because there was a post office strike, and they called up the military to deliver the mail in Manhattan. And it was a joke. Let me tell you, we couldn't find half these places, just, you know, those big skyscrapers.
Yeah.
We didn't do a very good job delivering them.
So what were your thoughts at that time? Like, you know, it was such a volatile time in the U.S. in terms of, you know, the Vietnam War, and your friends are going off. Were you, you know, people seem to fall into two sides of the camp. Were you kind of on the side where it was like, I really want to go and be a part and help out? Or were you kind of like, I'm glad I didn't have to go?
I would say generally, when I was back then 20 years old, I was probably glad that I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go, but I was certainly prepared to go because mm-hmm. when you join, that's what happens. And you know, I didn't understand what was really going on. I was a young kid, and I mean, Vietnam, I never heard of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't even know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing how naive I was about the world and geography and why that war was being fought. And, mm-hmm. you know, I just wasn't paying any attention to it. So when people said Vietnam, I'm saying, what's that?
Yeah.
And certainly we all found out what it was, because in 64, it wasn't really geared up yet.
Mm.
But back in 68, 69 is when it really started going. And so it was interesting times. But, you know, when you're young, you don't really fear anything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. I think that's why the Army's full of young people sign up and they go and give their lives for this country. Yeah.
So cause I always think it's an interesting time because my dad went to Vietnam and came back, and my mom didn't know him before, but he definitely had something that was a lingering. He just didn't talk about it. Like, he just wouldn't talk about his time there, what happened there. I'm pretty sure he had some sort of form of PTSD. You know, at the time, I don't realize that, but, you know, 20 years since, I could see it, how he had it. And, you know, it was just such an interesting time in America because it was really one of the first times that a major war was happening where there was kind of the for the war and against the war. So you were for the America.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And
that was a tough time. I had a few friends killed over there, and it was just hard to understand why we were there, I think, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
A little deeper than we understood it was, and didn't turn out very
yeah.
well. But
so
it's not uncommon for your dad, or most military people don't talk about the mm-hmm. war. My father-in-law was in for 32 years. He never talked about it.
Wow. Yeah. It's just, you just kind of don't want to know sometimes what they see. Mary's brother was on, when we went to Iraq in 2003, he was on, maybe 2003, his infantry was first in line. You know, he was an officer at 22, 23, because he went to the Naval Academy. And here he is coming into Baghdad, and he doesn't, you know, he said he saw three or four of his friends die, but he doesn't, doesn't really talk about it. It's kind of like, it happened, let's move forward. So,
well, my father-in-law graduated from the Naval Academy. He was in the class of 42. They graduated early because of Pearl Harbor. 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor, they were shipped off. Yeah, so.
Yeah. So, okay, so after I'm going to get depressed here about talking about death and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's life, don't get me wrong. So after you get out of the military, you start climbing up the ranks, right, doing these different jobs. What was it like to work for, you know, a big company like the Marriott?
Well, you know, I started out with Hilton, and I was just a waiter, so nobody paid any attention to me. And I didn't have a clue what was going on. I didn't even know hotels had a general manager. I just did my job and went along the line. I tell people I got ahead because I'm real reliable. I was there on time, did my job, I raised my hand, I have a good attitude. So, and I tell people when you don't have a college degree, you better have a good attitude. So that's how I kind of got going, and I just learned as I went. You know, I'm pretty curious, so I learned a lot every day. And next thing I knew more and more and more and more. And then I think my experience is what propelled my career. I kept learning a lot about each department I worked in. Mm-hmm. I tell people if you go to work, don't go home at night unless you've learned something new at work.
Well, I think he said something really, really important. And I think something that is sometimes missed, you're reliable, right? Like
I'm very reliable.
But I mean, I think just that and a positive attitude can take you really far in life. I will show up when I say I'm going to show up, and I will always be positive and be happy, you know? And I think it's a really basic formula, but I don't know why it's such a difficulty for a lot of people. Why do you think that's such a difficulty?
Well, I don't know, because I can tell you at least act happy.
Yeah.
You know, that's as we say at Disney, you don't have to be happy to work there. You got to act happy for 8 hours. So, and that's part of the game, you know, in life, you got to be that positive, uplifting person. Now, I don't know. I think part of it's genetic. I think you get part of it. Mm-hmm. My brother, he wasn't very positive. He was always negative. So, and he's an orthopedic surgeon. So, I don't know what happens. I think some people just take things too seriously and they blame somebody else for everything instead. And I just kind of go with the flow. I mean, nothing's that serious for me that I can't overcome it, I think, or it'll get better. When it gets bad, it'll get better. When I got fired once from a job, I got another job.
You know? Well, why'd you get fired?
I joined a company double my salary, and I went out and joined it in Pennsylvania, and they went bankrupt after 90 days, and I was out of job. And my wife told me not to go, but I told her I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So that was the first problem. But it, you know what, that got me to Marriott, where I had a great career. And so, you know, I can always get a job as a waiter. I'm not worried about working.
So what was it like working for these big companies, especially like Marriott, because that was more of a senior level position? What was it like working at this big, big company while you're still – because you're probably still relatively young at this point.
Yeah, I was doing pretty well. I was 27 when I got with Marriott in an executive position. And it's a bureaucracy, but Marriott was great because they expect you to do your job. They teach you how to be a good manager, watch the bottom line, watch your expenses, make a profit. I mean, Marriott family is really into management, keeping things under control, and I learned a lot there. And some bureaucracy, you know, there's always the politics of life, and it's there, but Marriott was great. I mean, it was unbelievable. And then at Disney, too, there's a lot of bureaucracy and politics. And so you just learn to play the game and go along with it and do your best. And it works out. If you fight it and don't have a good attitude and don't cooperate, don't get along with people, it's hard to be successful in a big company.
So, like, as you're moving around the world here, right, and I'm actually really interested to talk to you about Paris and that experience there. But before we get to that, you know, you sounds like you've been married for a really long time at this point. Like, you got married when you were probably, what, 19, 20?
No, I was married at 24. My wife was 22. Oh, okay. We're going to have in about 15 months, we're going to have our 50th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations. That is awesome.
Yeah. And my mother was married 5 times, so I'm getting the family average down.
Well, good for you for being an overachiever again. So, So what is your wife, as this is going on, like, what role is she playing in your decision-making and your thoughts?
Well, early on, she just kind of, her dad was an admiral. He finally finished as an admiral in the Navy. She had moved 12 times with him as he got redeployed and got stationed different places. So when she married me, there was never an issue. You know, we started in Washington, we moved to Chicago, and she's always ready to go. We lived in New York, and then we loved L.A., and we liked every place we lived. And And we moved 11 times in my career, so she's moved 23 times, and we've been in Orlando for 23 years without moving. So you can imagine those early days. Yeah. But we just went. We had an apartment. It was no big deal. We didn't have much stuff, so it was not a big move. And we just went, and we had fun.
She sounds like a really easygoing gal.
She's a saint.
Yeah.
I tell people, I know I'm getting better because she told me she's going to stay. Yeah. So
I feel the same way about my wife. We have our 10-year anniversary next month. And, you know, she was also a military kid, and she moved about five or six times. And, you know, I grew up in the same house, and then I didn't start moving until I went to college. And then since then, I've lived in three countries. You know, four kind of the U.S. and four big cities in the U.S. And I have an affinity now for living abroad. Like, I love the experience. I love kind of meeting people from around the world. And for me and for my kids, it's what a fantastic experience for my kids. So as
it's probably one of the best gifts you give them.
I think so. So when you move to Paris, then do you have kids at this point when you open Disneyland Paris?
No, we were lucky. Our son graduated from Boston University in 91, and I was already in Paris in 90. Mm. And actually, he came over and ended up getting a job as an hourly employee in the parking lot at Disneyland Paris because they were hiring warm bodies, and they could get an 18-month visa. So he did that, and then he fell in love there and married Valerie, and they've been married 23 years. She's French. And
does he still live there?
Got three grandkids, 21, 18, and 16.
Holy cow.
And we go to France almost every year. It's great. We love it there. The kids learn to speak French there. Our granddaughter right now is doing an internship at Disneyland Paris in marketing for the summer. And we just got a note from her a minute ago that she was on her way to take a good look at the Eiffel Tower at night. So.
And so does your son still live in Paris?
No, they came back. He stayed there 5 years. He's the vice president of the Magic Kingdom in Orlando.
Oh, wow.
He's been with Disney 25 years.
So what is it about Disney then that's so, not to use a lack of a better term, magical?
Oh, I think what makes it that way, I mean, we have our business issues like anything. We have to go through recessions and 9/11 and hurricanes and you name it. But name of the game is we hire better. We're very careful who we bring into the company. I mean, we have a big system to go through to make sure we hire the right people. And then we train better. We train them, we test them, and we enforce our training. And then I think the big thing is we have a culture where we really pay attention to everybody. Everybody matters, and they know it. Mm-hmm. And we make sure we encourage them and develop them and give them opportunities and encouragement and all those kinds of things. And you can hardly find a person who works at Disney or has worked there that didn't tell you it's great because of the way they're treated and the way they have opportunity to move up to a management position or as high as they can go.
So I was doing some research on you before we talked, and I actually saw one of the videos that you discussed that is that one of the traits that you really found is that I can't do it all well, so I hire the people around me who can, right? So when did you discover, like, that's the smarter way to go?
Well, I didn't know that when I was young. I was very insecure, obviously, the way I grew up. I was adopted twice after my mother was married five times and got my name Cockrell when I was 16, so I didn't have a college degree. So I was a pretty insecure young guy, so I had to act like I knew everything, you know, and everybody already knows you don't. So But I had I became very defensive. I didn't take feedback very well. And finally, one of my bosses helped me get over that. And he said, Lee, you don't need to know everything. The whole world doesn't revolve around Lee, so don't get so upset when I talk to you about things. And he worked, helped me out with that. And then I slowly but surely changed and started trusting people more and are learning that hiring great people is the name of the game. And I can tell you, when I was at Disney, I had unbelievable experts around me. And as people said, I don't know what they're supposed to be doing, but they do. And managing experts, you've got to let them do their thing. So you got to hire great ones. You can't hire idiots. And they do a great job. And so when you do that, you got to figure out where you're going to spend your time if you're not an expert in those places. And I did. I spent my time making sure we were hiring the right people. I was involved in those systems, making sure I was involved in training and also being a good role model for the culture of treating people right. That was my thing, and I pushed it hard. And when I do it, all my people under me did it, and it went all the way down. And, you know, role modeling is probably the best way people learn, mm-hmm. including your kids mm-hmm. at home.
So can I ask can I ask you a question? Because you said something earlier that really piqued my interest, and you can say pass on this if you want. But you had mentioned that your mom was married 5 times, and then you were adopted by, I'm assuming, 2 of her husbands throughout that process.
Yeah.
And so do you think that was kind of the biggest impact on you in terms of trust and personal growth? And do you think it stunted you in some ways or drove you? Okay.
No, it did. I didn't trust anybody. And I still have that little problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's down there. It's down there and it can come out, but I've learned to control it and to let it go. And my wife said recently, she said, "Lee, you don't aggravate me anymore." She said, "Why?" I said, "Because I decided to let it go."
Yeah.
It's like that song, Frozen, Let It Go. And I had to get over that because, you know, it's in you. Mm-hmm. What, by the time you're 12, 13, 14, whatever you are, it's in emotionally. Mm. And I've learned to control it, and I've learned to be more outgoing, and I learned to be less defensive because I know people don't want to work with defensive people. And
But how do you learn that, though? Like, how do you unpack that for yourself and say, hey, listen, everyone out there is not trying to screw me?
Yeah. Well, I had a problem with one of my people, Marriott. I went out to see him, and he had been transported to the hospital because he was so scared of me coming that he had had faint dizziness, and they checked him out. He came back, and we had dinner, and he told me that because the way I got things done in those days was intimidation. I abused my authority and pushed people around. And after he told me that, I really came to grips with it. I thought about my grandmother, my mother. They'd kill me if they knew I was behaving that way. Mm-hmm. And I started attending leadership courses. I went for a 3-day course, and I started reading about leaders that don't have authority and how they kind of work. And I did slowly, but it took me a long time to get over it. But slowly but surely, I had more success, and I learned to hire great people. And as my success got better, my self-confidence got better. And I would say today, you know, my self-confidence is really big, but there are still some down there lurking.
Sure.
That I have these reoccurring dreams about not having a college degree or things like that, they never go away.
So as you're going through that process, I mean, I imagine your relationship with your wife also improves.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
Because we'd get in an argument over nothing. And of course, I needed to win.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I learned that winning, you don't win. Mm-hmm. And usually it was something stupid. It was not even worth talking about.
Yeah. I think that's really, to me, I can relate so much to that because, you know, I overcompensated. So I have a PhD, right? So I went from the guy who graduated high school with a 2.5, who parents just begged to try college, like just give it a go. And then I went and then I quit. And then I went back and I finished with a 2.4. So I went the wrong direction. And then I kind of just kept stumbling along because I felt like, oh, I need to prove myself. I need to prove myself. I need to prove myself. And then, you know, early on in my marriage, and still compared to you, I'm an infant. Don't get me wrong. but you know, whenever Mary would question something I said, I'd get really defensive. Well, you don't believe me? You don't trust me? You don't think I'm right? Why are you questioning who I am as a person? And blah, 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 blah. And she would be like, what are you doing? Like, and I didn't get it. It took me a really long time to disconnect it. It was my own insecurities that drove my instant reactive behaviors.
Yeah, it'll always be up there in your brain a little bit.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you give me hope, Lee. You give me hope.
Well, I tell you, all your problems are in your brain.
Yeah. Well, my wife would sometimes say they're in my ass at times as well.
Well, that may be, but I can tell you, your brain lies to you every day.
Yeah, it's a fascinating tool. So, all right, what I want to do real quick is just do my fast 5. These are five random questions. And then let's talk about kind of the journey you're on now and the goals that you have with speaking and writing your books and what you're really hoping to accomplish. So are you ready to do fast 5?
Yes, sir.
Question 1. I know the answer to this, but you will answer it anyways. What was your first job ever?
Well, my first real job where I got money for it was actually milking a cow every morning because we had electric milkers, but this was my development program, I guess. So I had little white overalls I put on over my school clothes. I milked the cow. I sold it for the people across the street for 50 cents, and that was my first job. And then we just, as I got older, you had more and more chores to do on the farm. And then, yeah, I mean, that was kind of how it worked. Yeah. And I think like you, my parents made sure we were always kept busy, even when we left the farm. I mean, literally, we had, my brother and I were taught to clean the house, do our own washing, ironing. And my mother didn't fool around. I mean, you'd better do it right. And we had to mow the lawn, and we had to do – I mean, we had duties, and there was no screwing around. And so she was a disciplinarian, and, man, you did what she said. I tell people she was a terrorist before we had them in the world.
Yeah, you talk about baling hay earlier. Funny story. So I grew up – you know, my dad grew up in Colorado, ranged in Colorado, which was near some place where they baled lots of hay. But he had – in my head – my dad passed away when he was 49. I was 20. In my head, I swear he had Popeye arms. Like he had forearms because he had to do it with the hooks. So he would spend all summer long baling hay with the hooks. And I just remember like he had a death, like his hands were like iron fists. He'd get a hold of you and forget about it. You weren't getting done. So I can appreciate a hard day's work on a farm because I, not that I did it, but I felt the results of it later on in life. So, all right. Question two. Who do you, you know, you've lived a very fruitful, amazing journey in your life. Who do you admire most?
Oh, I think when I think about personal people close to me, I would tell you the one reason I'm not in prison now is my grandmother, who was the nicest person I've ever known. Mm-hmm. I never heard her say one negative word about anyone in her whole life. She served everybody. She was 36 when I was born, my grandmother.
Wow. And,
she had my mother when she was 17, and my mother had me when she was 19. So we had a very young family, and I had a lot of admiration. I think she taught me a lot about empathy. Mm. And I think, you know, when I think about it, my mother taught me discipline, my grandmother taught me empathy. And those two things, in your, if you have those two in your career, discipline and empathy, you can go a long way. I think back about that a lot.
Do you think how do you compare empathy and compassion?
Well, I think they're on the same – they're on the same line. I mean, empathy is, you know, I think about empathy is understanding how you're coming across to people and being aware that you're talking to three people. Make sure you understand how each one of them are hearing you, how it's coming off, being just getting to know people better, paying more attention. And then, you know, the compassion, I think, is doing whatever you can do to help people when they're having difficulties in their life. And I'm willing to do that. And people have done it for me. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, you see a lot of people today in Wall Street and other places that don't show much compassion.
Yeah. It's a me attitude.
Yeah. And I mean, I get notes from people every day that send me a note saying, thanks for that time you helped me back in that, you know, 10 years ago this year. That's the best satisfaction you can get when somebody appreciates you for helping them.
I talk about this quite often on my podcast. I'm kind of going through this phase in my life now, you know, I'm only 42. I realize that. I have 4 kids, 9, 7, 4, and 2. So I'm still in the thick of it. I'm on my last diaper changing. I cannot wait till I'm done with that. I told my wife we will crack a bottle of champagne the day that our daughter's potty trained, because that means I am out. No more diapers.
That's good.
So, but I'm in this phase where I'm, you know, I think in your 20s, you're a certain type of person, 30s, you're evolving. And now in my early 40s, I'm really focused on just giving to other people. If someone needs something, a connection, introduction, like 95% of the time, I'm willing to do it. As long as I think it's a match and a fit, not just for the sake of doing it. But I really try to go out of my way trying to help people at the end of a call. So I feel like, you know, as you were just saying, the more you do that, and I see this with tons of leaders that I interview, the more they tend to get back in a career, in a career, friendships and things like that.
I can tell you, every time I help somebody, I don't expect anything. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, something happens a year later, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years later. I mean, it's amazing.
That's awesome.
And I think when you're committed to people, they'll be committed to you. And that's you got to do things for people without expecting anything.
Yeah, and that's a huge lesson. All right, so question three is actually a part A and a part B, and this will make sense in a second. So what animal best defines your management style? Now, part A is when you were in your 30s, Part B is when you were in your 50s, early 60s.
Well, my nickname at Marriott was Doberman. So that'll tell you about my management style.
All right.
I would say today it's Cocker Spaniel. I mean, I can bite, but I don't.
Yeah. You'll bark more than bite.
I bark. I don't bite anymore. So, and I don't even bark that much anymore. I just kind of more candid with people, tell them the truth. And I tell them, I'm telling you the truth for your sake, not for mine. And that's true. Doberman, that's what I was called. And, you know, Dobermans are not nice.
I thought you were going to describe yourself in terms of a Cocker Spaniel that doesn't bark. The Cocker Spaniel just rolls over and has people scratch their belly instead.
Well, you know, if you've been a Doberman, a lot of people are afraid to pet you.
Yeah. So. Which is funny. That's a fantastic analogy of kind of where you're at. Like, you kind of kept people away from you from a trust perspective.
I did.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right.
And I was introverted too. I mean, you know, so really? I had to work hard to get more extroverted, yeah. Be able to sit, talk to people, walk into a room and not feel pressured. And
I bet you really need some downtime though, like after you go out and do it for a while.
I do. I'm totally exhausted after I do that.
Yeah. Okay, well then I'll hurry up so your nap is a little bit better. All right, question four. You know, in your history of working, what are the traits that annoy you, drive you craziest in your colleagues?
Well, the number one is that people are not disciplined and organized and do what they say they're going to do and keep their promises, and that they have credibility and I can count on them. I mean, that's the big one for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I tell somebody I'm going to do something, I have a good day planner and I do it. And I say, you can stake your life. If I tell you I'm going to call you Friday at 5:00, that call will come through or I'm dead.
Yeah.
So that's what I want, reliability and credibility, and I want people to keep their promises. And I think that's how you build trust. And if you don't have trust, you can't get anything done.
Yeah.
And people trust me.
Yeah, there's no bridges built at that point. So,
yep.
All right, final question. So the opposite of that in some ways is, what brings out the best in Lee? What situations?
I would say teaching. That's why I'm doing what I do today, the writing the books, speaking, doing seminars. People say, Lee, why do you do that? I said, because people applaud. And I said, you know, when I play golf, nobody applauds, so I don't do that. And I get a thrill out of teaching. And I think we need more teachers and less bosses. That's how I think about it. I wake up every morning now, not like when I was younger. Now I wake up and see how I can make people happier instead of sadder like I did in my early days. And that's where you get – when people appreciate you, it's a big satisfaction. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's huge.
So right now I'm actually an assistant professor at a university in the Middle East. And yeah. You know, what I hope to do is transition out of this for the next 15 years, but come back to it later on. Because I feel like someone like you here to come into a classroom and teach even like a 3-week course, the amount of knowledge that you can espouse and spew onto the students would just be so valuable that it just would be amazing. Like, do you ever have a chance to get into the classroom?
I do. I speak to a lot of classes. In fact, universities and high school students, and I do it pretty regularly. We're creating a whole online system for colleges and universities and for corporations. I've already got the first one developed. It's time management online. People can take the course online. We're going to do one on leadership, one on management, one on customer service, and that. We'll roll out that website probably in a couple of weeks. It's called the New York Distance Learning Association, NYDLA. And I'm really getting excited about it because when I talk to students, I'm so candid with them and straightforward. And after they hear all the things I went through, they're sure that they can be successful. And I worry about that with kids because a lot of people underestimate what they can do, and I don't want them to do that. Mm-hmm. I really underestimated what I could do. And people say, What'd you always want to be? I said, I was just happy to keep my job. I didn't want them to find out I didn't know what I was doing. And as I got stronger, I knew that I could do that. I mean, if you told me I could write a book, now I've got 4 out. I barely passed English in high school. I mean, you know, the future has a lot. And your best work is ahead of you. And I love catching students when they're young, because they really suck it up and they love it and they learn. And yeah, my books are being used in a lot of universities now. We've got a teacher's manual for we went out to 1,200 professors on creating magic. It's a 12-week course. They can teach right from the manual. We got one on time management. They can teach, or the people can take them through it themselves. And I'm really getting excited about this stuff, because a lot of kids need to hear this stuff today.
So that kind of leads me to the last 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes of the podcast here. So you obviously have this passion for education. Now, I'm going to make a huge assumption that the reason why you're so passionate is because you perhaps didn't ever acquire it. And now you have it and you can disseminate it, right?
Absolutely. I wish that I had been exposed to stuff I know now, because it – I mean, I'm not kidding you. I give a lot of speeches, you know. Mm-hmm. I went to Kuwait and did a couple, and I am probably going to go back there and maybe in November to Dubai. I work with a group over there at Books Seminars and – has had me there, you know. And I went to Baghdad in 2011, did 13 seminars for the army during the war. And yeah, it's something that you got to really think deeply. If you know something, you ought to be teaching it. Mm-hmm. And share it with people. I always say, first you learn it in the classroom, then you go out and do it in business, and then you start teaching it. That's kind of learn it, do it, teach it. And I had a great quote the other day from a company I was doing work for. I said, how are you guys so successful? He said, we have three things we focus on. We hire them right, we train them right, and we treat them right. Mm. And, you know, it's simple stuff.
It is simple. So as you wrote, what was your first book you wrote?
It's called Creating Magic, 10 Common Sense Leadership Strategies from a Life at Disney.
And so as you wrote that, so I'm in the middle of writing my first book. And so I was explaining this to my wife last night. I actually have a lot of anxiety. I mean, a tremendous amount, because you really are putting yourself out there when you write it. And so as you're writing this, what were the fears that you were having? Because I have a ton right now.
Well, my first fear is I didn't even know I could write a book. I mean, I was going like, what? And you talk about anxiety. I have anxiety too. And it was probably put in there when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, 6 years old. I don't know when. I take medication for it, unlike you. Because personal things get to me when my grandkids have a problem, or my wife was sick and almost died a few years ago, and I suffered from anxiety and depression for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And doctor told me that all came back from my childhood about those insecurities. And so I was insecure about writing a book. Is anybody going to buy it? You know, people say, come and have a book signing. I didn't want to, because I was afraid nobody would come.
Sure. I know. I imagine that, right?
And so we got it out there, and today it's in 16 languages. And it's doing great, selling better than it ever has, and it's been out since 08. Classrooms are adopting it, and colleges, and I sit back and think, wow, I can't believe this happened. And so, and getting it done, you got to really, if you're going to write a book, you got to have discipline. You got to get right every day and get it finished.
Oh,
set yourself a target date. I wrote every morning from 8 to 10 until I got done.
So I'm actually doing a completely different method. So tomorrow morning, for example, I've created an outline, and in this outline, every heading and subheading is a question. And so my wife is interviewing me. We're going to record it. And basically, I'm going to record the book, transcribe it, and then edit it so it's in a nice format, and then give it to a copy editor.
And so, good.
And so
great.
I'm a much faster talker than I am a writer. Because writing, I start thinking about too much about the wordsmithing and about this. And the content of the book is really focused on being authentic at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So talking for me is most authentic. But as you're writing this book, right? So I'm kind of back on this anxiety thing. It launches. Did you basically bite your nails down to the cubicles and think like, what the hell did I just do? Or were you like, when did the confidence start to come? Let me ask that question. When did the confidence start to come?
Well, I had a double problem. My wife almost died during that period, and I couldn't even go on any book trips. I had to do it all on radio interviews. I didn't travel for a year and a half till she got better, and she's fine today. But I was stuck.
Did she have cancer?
No, she had a failed bowel resection surgery.
Oh,
was in the hospital 67 days. She had a bill was $700,000. I had Disney insurance, but it was critical. And then I ended up with this anxiety and depression over it, taking care of her for almost 2 years. Mm. And so I did radio interviews. I didn't take one trip, which I really had a whole line of them lined up because there's companies out there that'll, you know, they'll book all of them for you. Or, and I booked a morning drive time show, and because I could talk about Disney and the book. And so, yeah, I just waited to see what happened. I got a very large advance for the first book from Random House. So I wasn't too concerned because I got paid already. But, and then the second book I did, they asked me to do, and I got an even bigger advance. So, but they like me because I work hard at it. I do speeches every week. I talk about the books. My customers buy books when I go speaking. I had one last week, bought 1,400. One before, I bought 700. Wow. Random House loves me. They said I'm the ideal author because I'm always out there working it. I work it on social media. I post every day about my books and what's learning and my seminars and So exposure. A lot of authors write it, put the book down, and don't go out and promote it.
Yeah. I have a very, very strong marketing plan that I'm doing. So that
That's the name of the game.
I mean, I mean, I think it's a very solid plan because I don't have your name, I don't have your title, I don't have your position. So I've got to create buzz about what I'm doing in a different way. But, you know, because my background is marketing, that's what I teach, putting the, to your point, the theory into practice. So just kind of obviously.
Well, I think the key, by the way, the key is you got to be able to say to people very shortly, why should, what am I going to learn from reading your book? Well, how's this going to make me a better business person, father, mother, whatever?
What's in it for them at the end of the day?
In it for me? That's why I read a book. That's why I go to a program or a lecture. What's in it for me?
So, well, I have you just for a few more minutes. I had, oh my gosh, I had a string of questions right there. How do you, how do you still connect? How do you think you still connect with, the kids in college, the younger, like, how do you think you're able to connect with them still?
Well, a couple of things. I go to Starbucks every morning at 6:30. I read the New York Times, and I meet with anybody who wants to meet with me every morning. It's usually young people, and they tell me what's going on, what's happening. And I have two or three sites I read every day online that are sent to me automatically, kind of what's going on in the world with technology and leadership and management and customer service and millennials. And I now have three grandkids that are grown up down the street from me that are 21, 18, and 16, and they keep me well informed about what's happening and what they're, and I communicate with them, and I spend a lot of time with young people, and I think they're,
It a point. Like, you make a strong effort to make sure you're staying in tune with what's going on.
Oh, absolutely, because it's different. I mean, just staying up with technology, I'm an old guy here, and I keep up with it, and I use it, and my grandkids are impressed that I'm on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn with my work, and that Pappy has the latest Samsung Galaxy 8, and he knows how to use it, and he can podcast, and he has his own podcast, and he has, they go, whoa.
So you're like the hip grandpa, really.
My grandkids told me they hear a lot of their friends saying, complaining when they have to go visit their grandparents. And he said, we love to visit our grandfather.
Well, there's no better joy than that, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, it is true. And they relate. And by the way, I always took them on a business trip with me. You might think about it with your kids. Every year I would take the kids when they were 8, 9, 10, 12. I would take a business trip, and I'd take one of them at a time. So I took one when I spoke to the Navy SEALs. I took my young grandson. I took another one when I did some work for SeaWorld in San Diego. I took another one out to the desert in California when I went to speak to the military out there. We had a great trip together. And so they got to know me really, really well, and hearing me speak and reading my books. And so I think they relate in a different way. I'm not the grandfather that's over there sleeping in the corner.
Yeah.
And I'm in good shape, too. They're surprised that I can probably still outrun them.
So. What are you, like a seven-minute mile?
I can I work out every day for 40 minutes on my Stairmaster, and I do strength training twice a week. Just to keep my abs strong and keep my core strong, because I'm worried about bone density and I don't want to fall and break a hip one day.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's kind of the beginning of the end. So I pay attention to those things.
Well, this is my last question, Lee, I have. Thank you so much. Is, you've had this incredible life, so your perspective on this would be really interesting. Like, how do you define happiness for where you're at?
you know, I used to define it as if I was happy. And now I think about, is everybody in my life happy? Mm-hmm. So if my wife's happy and I'm happy and my grandkids are happy, but when somebody in the family's not happy, I'm not happy. And I used to be a little selfish that way, that I didn't pay much attention to what was going on around me and what other people were going through. And today I understand that you can't be happy unless your kids and your wife are happy. Mm-hmm. And to pay attention to that. That's, you know, and pay attention to your health.
Yeah.
I tell people, if you don't take care of your health, it'll be the largest regret you have in your life when you lose it, when you could have done something about it. Mm. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, Lee Cockrell, thank you so much for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Yeah, thanks, James. Good to meet you, and good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. You too.